today is kind of assessing a little bit about what we know or don't know about social trends. So one of the things that I've noticed in my 12 years of teaching is that a lot of us think we know what's going on in the social world. We have common sense. We hear things on TV. We see things in the news. And one of the things I do on my first day in my introduction class is I go through a series of 10 questions and just kind of assess and have the students assess. I don't collect them. How much people have an understanding of what's really going on. So we're going to go through some things today, and I'm going to ask you questions. Some of them are multiple choice questions. Some of them are fill-in-the-blank questions, and some of them are trends. So they'll ask you, do you think that this thing, this social trend, is increasing or decreasing or staying about the same? So staying about the same basically means there's no statistical evidence of it going up or down in a general pattern. So there might be some up or down throughout the years, but by and large, it's staying about the same. And then some of the answers are in percentages. I actually prefer to look at social trends because it's hard to take one percentage or one statistic and put it in a social context. But I do have some questions like that because it's just kind of interesting to sort of figure out, for example, what percentage of women who have abortions are already mothers. So that's like one question. We're going to go through all the questions, and then after we go through the questions, we'll do all the answers at once. So it might seem a little bit like you're in school. All right, the first question is, oh, I forgot, considerations here. So the first thing is, the questions are a bit gender heavy. So I teach several sections of Introduction to Sociology every semester, online and seated. But I also teach a class called Gender in Society every year, so that's why there's a few more gender questions than some of the other topics. The other thing, I just want to remind people that our language is continually evolving, especially as it relates to race, ethnicity, gender, and sexuality. And so the words that I use here are the words that were in the actual research studies. Okay, so large data sets, which is what these are based off of, probability samples, national samples, etc. They're always a few years behind in the language that they use. So just kind of an acknowledgement of that. So the first question is, the U.S. teenage pregnancy rate is A, B, or C. And you will not be handing these in. Don't put your name on them. So just take your best guess. The U.S. teen pregnancy rate.
Aggregate, everybody. All races, everybody.
Yes, as a whole, yeah. And if you have questions, just let me know. I'm actually not used to standing up and just talking for a while. So questions, if you want clarification, just let me know. All right, the second one. In 2011, what percent of pregnancies among U.S. women were unintended? 2011, what percent of all pregnancies among U.S. women were unintended? If I click and you're not ready, say go back. Let's go back. All right, the U.S. abortion rate is increasing, decreasing, or staying about the same. This is, again, as a whole, the U.S. abortion rate as a whole. What percentage of women obtaining abortions are already mothers? A lot of these are things you probably haven't thought about before. Some of them are things that you maybe already know the answer to. Okay, what percentage of abortion patients are poor or low income?
So how do you define, is that like 40% of median or?
Okay, so for this question, poor is defined as 100% of the poverty level or below, the official U.S. Census poverty threshold. And low income is 100 to, I think it's 149%, or it could be 199%. So basically double the poverty threshold. And in 2006, I think the poverty threshold for a family of three was about 26,000. All right, what percentage of abortions are completed during the first trimester? I think we only have two abortion questions left, so. What percentage of abortions do you think are completed during the first trimester? All right, and then the last one, I think, of abortion-related questions. What percentage of abortions are completed at 21 weeks or later? 21 weeks or later. So here I could say termination of pregnancy, for example, but these are the wording that is used by the CDC. Hmm. All right, what percentage of high school students report that they have ever had sexual intercourse? percentage of high school students report that they have ever had sexual intercourse.
Is this like a recent year? Pretty recent year?
I can't remember offhand.
Is this like all grades?
Yes, it's all grades, including 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th. Correct. Good question. One of the topics we cover in my gender class is sex education. And it's one of my favorite topics to talk about because students have a lot to say about it. And they have a lot to say about what their experience was in high school and the kind of sex education they had or didn't have. And we go through a sheet that looks at all the states and all of their different requirements for many, many different things. And one question is, how many of the 50 states, in addition to DC, mandate sex education? And then we have a similar question about HIV education. How many of the 50 states, in addition to DC, mandate HIV education? This is a really interesting one, I think. Of the states that mandate sex or HIV education, what percent require that the instruction be medically accurate?
We can just make stuff up.
It is not 100%, I will tell you. It is not 100%. There are also states that do not allow students to ask questions during the sex education curriculum. So there's a wide range of sex education out there by state. All right, so moving on to generally different topics, the U.S. divorce rate. Increasing, decreasing, or staying about the same? The percentage of high school students who smoke cigarettes.
Traditional cigarettes.
Traditional tobacco cigarettes. Yes.
Not e-cigs. E-cigs, are they included in there? E-cigs.
This is from, I think, 2015, so I'm not sure.
Less about that.
I'm not sure if e-cigarettes are included in there. That's a good question. All right, percentage of students who drink and drive. I have the exact wording of the question when we get to the results. Increasing, decreasing, or staying about the same? Okay, this is an open-ended question about the wage gap. And it is kind of a trick question. I'm just going to tell you that right now. It's kind of a trick question. How do you think the wage gap is measured? Or you can leave a blank and just wait for the answer. But there are two different U.S. government organizations that measure the wage gap.
Gender gap.
Yes, sorry. The wage gap between men and women. Sorry.
Okay.
Yep. Thank you for asking that question. There are two U.S. government organizations that measure it, and they measure it differently. So that's a trick question part of it. All right, so here we have another fill-in-the-blank one. We have a median weekly income for full-time wage and salary workers. We have women and men separated out here. And they use this information to...
Is this adjusted income?
Pardon?
Is it straight up income or adjusted income?
Straight up. Yep.
Before tax.
Yes. Gross. Before taxes. And notice it says full time, right? So a lot of people are going to be left out of this.
Yeah.
One of the problems of gathering data is it's really hard to get complete data.
Wait, because we're trying to do a week.
You're right. Yeah, weekly. I know. I actually do, in the answer, I have the annual income. Both, the weekly and
okay.
annual.
Oh, okay, so you could do annual.
Yeah, you could do annual.
Let's do annual.
I've done the math for you.
Okay.
Okay, this is a new topic here. Between 1970 and 2014, police officer deaths increased, decreased, and stayed about the same.
Is this deaths of police officers?
Yes, deaths of police officers. Police officers who died. Yes,
in
the line of duty. Yes,
in
the line of duty. Yeah.
This was before.
Yeah, 2014, right? As I said, official data sets are always behind. So, for example, the most recent detailed report of homicides in Chicago is from 2011. Because it has information about what time of death did it occur. Was it indoors or outdoors? What time of day? I mean, all sorts of questions, and it takes them a long time to do that. So that's why 15 and 16 are not included in this. Between 2005 and 2015, the number of stories, of new stories, on violence against police increased, decreased, or stayed about the same. So this question is about news stories on TV, not in the newspaper, on TV, about violence against the police. All right, looking at homicide rates and the death penalty. Which states tend to have higher homicide rates? Is it states with the death penalty, states without the death penalty, or neither, meaning that there's really no noticeable correlation between homicide rates and the death penalty? Okay, number 20. Between 1980 and 2016, incarceration rates in the United States have increased, decreased, or stayed about the same. 21. Between 2004 and 2015, the annual rate of violent hate crime victimization increased, decreased, or stayed about the same. So the current things we have been that we have seen are not in the official data sets yet. So from 2004 to 2015. And this is all forms of hate crimes. So they document multiple forms of hate crime. The percent of US high school students reporting that drugs were made available to them during the past 12 months, okay, has that percentage increased, decreased, or stayed about the same? I'm pausing because the slide with the answer says, and I can't remember offhand. But you'll find out in a few minutes when we get there. All right, compared to other nations, fourth graders in the US report higher, average, or lower rates of bullying than fourth graders in other countries. We hear a lot about bullying, and I'll be talking more about the bullying and harassment on Wednesday and Thursday. So it's a different kind of session on Wednesday and Thursday.
Is it all other countries, or like mostly developed countries?
It's a combination of all kinds of countries. Okay. Yeah. Not every country, but a wide range of countries. Yeah. Not just like Canada or something. All right, 24. The percent of high school students reporting that they have been in a physical fight in the previous 12 months increased, decreased, or stayed about the same. All right, we have five more questions to go, and then we get to look at what some of the answers are. So between 2001 and 2015, the percent of US 12 to 18-year-olds who report that gangs were present during the school year, has that percentage increased, decreased, or stayed about the same? Between 2001 and 2015, the percent of US 12 to 18-year-olds who report that gangs were present during the school year. All right, this question was inspired by a presentation yesterday by Chris when he was talking about race. And the reason it's in here is because I was reviewing my presentation yesterday and I realized I had one question twice. So I thought, I'll go back to one of the things I talk about when we talk about race and ethnicity, and that is the U.S. Census. So the U.S. Census has changed the categories for racial and ethnic groups for the past couple hundred years. And there's a great website from Pew Research, on Pew Social Trends, that has the categories for every single decade. Okay, and there's I just kind of pulled one randomly out, right? So don't expect someone to know this question, right? But which of the following was not a race category when they took the census in 1920? Mexican, Hindu, Black, White, or Mulatto? What percent of US adults say people being harassed or bullied online is a major problem? The options were major problem, minor problem, and not a problem. Those were the three options that they could choose. Major, minor, or not a problem. So what percent of US adults say people being harassed or bullied online is a major problem? Okay, between 2005 and 2013, the median household income decreased for either all racial and ethnic groups or all groups except white, non-Latina, Latino, or all groups except Asian Americans. Median household income between 2005 and 2013. All right, 2013. The net worth of white non-Hispanic households was approximately how many times greater or larger than that of Hispanic and Black households? So notice here I said Hispanic, the last one I said Latino, because the questions were asked differently in the original data sets. 2013, the net worth of white non-Hispanic households was approximately how many times larger than that of Hispanic and black households? All right, and ready for the final question?
Mm-hmm.
All right, number 30. The average number of years between when a gay, lesbian, or bisexual adult thought they might be gay, lesbian, or bisexual, and when they told someone is how many years?
When was that?
Recently.
It's changed so dramatically.
Right, I know. For example, T is not on here, transgender is not on here, queer is not on here, but it's recent, which is why I was sort of surprised. And this goes back to what I said at the very beginning about terminology changing. Part of the reason why it is slow to change, and it's not justifying it, but it's slow to change is because we need to ask very similar questions. If we change the questions or we change the categories over time, it'll mess up comparisons, but it's messy. All right, so, ready?
Yeah.
Kathy, woo, you're excited. All right, so, the U.S. teen pregnancy rate is decreasing. How many of you are right? Yes. Okay, so this is what I thought would happen. So I teach at a community college in a relatively conservative area of Minnesota, and our service area is the least, has the lowest educational attainment of the state. And when I ask this question to my students, almost every single person gets it wrong. So almost all of them think that it is increasing. Okay, so why might it be decreasing?
Better sex ed.
Better sex ed?
Access to birth control.
Access to birth control, okay? Those are the main reasons. We also have fewer people who are getting married as teenagers. So that is another reason why. All right, here's a graph here. Abortion pregnancy rates have declined in teenagers in the U.S. So we have 1990 to 2009. Pregnancy and abortion rates have both declined. In 2011, 45% of all pregnancies among U.S. women were unintended. It's kind of high. I think most people would think it was quite a bit lower. All right, the abortion rate that was in the previous question as well has decreased quite significantly over the last couple decades. Here's a chart here looking at it. Roe versus Wade, it peaked in about 1980 and then is basically at the lowest it's been since they started recording.
Was that 14 per thousand or 14 per...
Number 14.6 for 1,000 women.
15 to 44.
Ages 15 to 44. And it's from Guttmacher, but it's Centers for Disease Control. They are the ones who track these health statistics. All right, 59% of women obtaining abortions are already mothers. And about the only group of people who are seeing an increase in the abortion rate are white women in their 20s. Almost all other groups are seeing a decline. And that's not like a huge uptick, but just a little bit. Okay, about 75% of abortion patients in 2014 were poor or low income. So if we break it down further, about half of them had incomes less than 100% of the poverty level or poverty threshold, and 26% between 100 and 199, or double the federal poverty level. All right, what percentage of abortions are completed during the first trimester? 91.4, approximately. I keep forgetting to ask you now, because you guys did so well in the first one, I keep forgetting to ask you what some of your guesses were.
Right on the nose.
Right on the nose. 80?
90.
90?
80.
80? 98. 98? Okay. The next one is what percent are 21 weeks or later? We have 1.4% and 1.3%, depending on. So we have in 2011, the CDC said it was 1.4. In 2013, Guttmacher, who uses CDC, says 1.3%. So, I really should have done this with where I would ask the question and then click on the answer. Didn't think that far ahead. All right, what's the next question? Let's see, can I ask it without seeing the answer? No. Okay. What percentage of high school students report that they have ever had sexual intercourse? Female and male. There are only two options in this survey. So how many of you were sort of in this similar bracket, like 5%-ish?
30%.
35? Were other people way high or way low?
60.
Okay, a lot of people were much higher, yeah. And someone up there asked a clarifying question about the age, right?
Yeah.
And this does include 9th and 10th graders as well. If we only asked juniors and seniors, it would be quite a bit different. All right, sex ed. 23 states and D.C. mandate sex education.
I guess 25. I thought 30 was high.
Is that 30?
30.
30? 35, 10? 25. 25? What about there? 30, 25? Okay. Yep, it's fewer than you think. The next question is about HIV education. Before I click on the answer, what do you think it is? 10, 0, 20, 10, 30, 5, 33. Yes! More states mandate HIV education than sex education. All right, the next one I know offhand, or I wish I knew all the order of all of them. The next one is about how many of them are medically accurate, right?
Zero.
So what?
No, you said how many are required to be medically accurate.
Yes, you're right. How many of the programs require that they be medically accurate?
Probably just
10. So one person said zero, one person said 40. 50? 10? 75. 30? About 50.
Yeah.
Yeah, way to go.
That's nice.
We shouldn't be celebrating.
I mean,
so what do they say? You can just say whatever you want?
Yeah, the other half is just making stuff up.
Make
Kathy probably knows a lot about this.
Not necessarily.
No, you don't. Okay.
Actually, I was off a lot.
Okay.
Yeah.
There are a lot of states that really focus on abstinence only. And a lot of those states really don't require that they be medically accurate. It doesn't mean that they are lying, really, but they can say things that are things that aren't really backed up by research. So things like things can cause breast cancer, things can cause ovarian cancer, all those kinds of things
to
that
scare
aren't really,
people.
Yeah, to scare people, basically. Also talking about fetal pain and that kind of stuff. So. There's just a wide range, and my assumption was that they all had to be medically accurate.
I've heard horror stories of people being like, straight is the only orientation. If you're not, you're wrong. Public school.
Yeah. Right.
Like, and it's stupid.
Right, because a lot of curriculum is based at the local level, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so there is a lot of flexibility. So if there's not a mandate from the state that the sex education or HIV education be medically accurate, it's really at the whim of who's on the school board, right? And what kind of pressure they're getting from some people who live in town.
I don't exist on like 3 years.
All right, the divorce rate is decreasing. How many of you got that one right? Okay, good. The divorce rate, it has been, that's the next one. I'll just tell you. Divorce rate has been decreasing since about 1980. It peaked a long time ago.
Does that have anything to do with the amount that people are getting married later?
Yes, the fewer.
Probably.
Yeah, there
fewer
are
teen marriages.
And there are actually fewer marriages in general.
Oh.
Yeah.
So the divorce rate is going down, and the marriage rate is also going down. So what happened is the divorce rate peaked in 1980, and most likely because in the 60s and 70s, divorce laws across the country changed. And you used to have to check in most states a reason why you were getting divorced. And oftentimes, it was infidelity, perhaps alcoholism, or severe abuse. Severe abuse because a general level of abuse was often tolerated. And so you had to click the reason in many states, and in some states you had to also say who was at fault. So we started to change and have no-fault divorce. And so all of a sudden in the 60s and 70s, the divorce rate skyrocketed. And then we have, it's been going down slightly, okay, but it is a noticeable yet small decrease since 1980.
Anything else? But
yeah, it's just an anecdotal example. We have some family that got divorced in California in the 1940s, and he was an attorney for like Hollywood people. I don't really know the details. And she stayed at home on the ranch and took care of business at home. And it was the husband who had an affair, and that caused them to get divorced. But when they went to sign the paperwork, they had to say whose fault it was and what that person did. And their conversations were around the fact that if he is at fault, because it's all in the paper, you know. Back then, this is all public record, and it was all in the paper. So people would open the paper in many, I mean, not everywhere, right, but in many areas, and see, oh, who got divorced, and oh, whose fault was it? Oh, that's really interesting. So they said that she had the affair because it would hurt his business if it was him. So, I mean, this is still public information, but it's not publicized the same way. You know, small town newspapers were much more likely to put this kind of, these public announcements in the paper way back a long time ago. In the 80s, when I visited my grandparents in a small town in Minnesota, we were in the paper the next week. Oh. Arthur and Virginia Olson had visitors from Owatonna, Minnesota. Son, yeah. Stephen and his wife Ricky and their two children, Sven Eric and Kirsten. So, yeah. Had to change a little bit. All right, the percentage of high school students who smoke. How many of you got this right? It's decreasing. All right, excellent. And actually quite dramatically. So this is a huge shift if we're looking at stats. Over the course of 20 years, a 10% decrease is actually quite a bit. Actually, it's only 10 years. Pardon me. Only 10 years. Does anyone know the main reason for this? It's education, but it's tied to a particular thing.
Advertising.
Yes. A lawsuit about advertising. Right? So the smoking tobacco companies lost a lawsuit in the late 1990s that said that they were targeting youth. Joe Camel. Yep. And so what happened then is the court settlement said, you have to pay millions or billions of dollars every year in anti-smoking campaigns for kids. Okay. So what we see here is that it worked. Yeah, it worked. So that public campaign to not smoke worked. In a session yesterday in Chris's session about race and the construction of race and this kind of stuff, one of the topics that came up was, well, why do we gather this information? Why do we categorize people into racial groups and into gender and into age? Why do we do all this stuff? And from a sociological perspective, it's because of this. We can then see what are the social trends, because a lot of times we are wrong if we're not actually looking at data. I mean, my assumptions about how the social world work is they're not always right. And so that's really why we need data, but good data, to look at this stuff. So we can see, that lawsuit where we made them pay billions of dollars, it worked. And so I anticipate this is going to continue to go down, and then it will probably reach a level and stay about the same level for quite a while, right? Because we're never going to get it down to zero if we're going to be realistic. All right, so here's past month cigarette use among youths age 12 to 17 by gender. Goes down for both males and females from 2002 to 2013. All right, drinking and driving. How many of you were right? It's decreasing. Okay, about half. Another huge decrease in the percentage of high school students who say that they drink and drive. And it is based on their responses, so it's possible that people are lying, right? But it's not likely that more people are lying now than in the past. So we have, again, a fairly large decrease. Most of my students also get this question wrong. They think maybe that their parents or their grandparents never did this. But this is something that sociologists would focus on as a social construction of a problem. So when my parents were young, people were drinking and driving, but there wasn't a public awareness of it being a social problem. People just did it. And they probably were driving slower. They weren't maybe driving as many miles, and so there were probably fewer deaths. Yeah. And so now when we see, well, there's more deaths, and then it's on TV, and we all hear about it, and then suddenly our society changes, and we say this thing that's been going on for a long time, now we actually think it's a problem. So we're going to start focusing resources on it, and then we see a significant decrease.
I'm not sure how big Uber was in 2001. I bet that's a recent fact.
Yeah, that's a great point. So what he said is, I don't think that Uber was around in 2011. Right, right. I don't think it was, but I'm not the one to ask.
Help it decrease.
Yeah. All right, so here, here's the exact question. Percentage of high school students aged 16 and over who drove when they had been drinking alcohol. So about 22-23% in 1991, down to 10% or so. All right, here's a complicated one. It's like, good luck getting this one right. So the wage gap, this is the gender wage gap, but you can use it to measure wage gaps between all different demographics, right? I mean, we can look at African Americans and whites, white Hispanics and whites, all different sort of groups. The Census Bureau, the way they measure it is the annual wages for all male and female workers regardless of occupation. The Bureau of Labor Statistics, the weekly earnings of workers in full-time wage and salary position from the census. So they take the census data, but they only use some people. Okay. And then this does not account for self-employed workers, though it does include people left out of the year-round wage measure. I mean, so it gets really complicated. So that's why when you hear conflicting information, it's because it's not really, like, let's say Democrats say one number and Republicans say another number. It's not because one of them is necessarily lying, right? It's because you're using different data. Republicans and Democrats also use different numbers when they look at the average income. So average is multiple kinds of averages, right? There's a mean, the median, and the mode. Well, they give you different numbers. And so the Democrats, they want to show a lower number. The Republicans want to show a higher number. So as a result, the Democrats will use what most of us would consider, usually I'm writing on the board. So, all right, if you take the median, right, you line them all up and you go in this way, you're going to get a lower number. That's the number the Democrats tend to use, right? The Republicans tend to use the mean. You add them all up and divide by the number. Because there's some people who are really, really, really wealthy, and they skew the number higher. So it makes it look like our average income is a lot higher. So if you're hearing groups of people and they're using different numbers, they probably have a reason why they're using the number, but they might not necessarily be making it up, right? Even though you might want to think they're making it up, they might not actually be making it up. All right, I asked you about the median weekly income. I've done the math for you, but for women, 726. Men, 895, which translates into about $8,000 difference for full-time. right?
Boy, I had 800 for men.
We know a lot of people do not work full time. All right, police officer deaths. Increase, decrease, or stayed about the same? What do you think?
Decrease.
Well, the answer's right here. I keep forgetting. Yes, they decreased.
Okay. The last 2 years.
And once again, I can't use the most recent data because it isn't available yet. I mean, you'll hear reports, but they're not complete reports yet. What about news stories about violence against the police?
Increase.
Oops, I got a step ahead of myself here. So this is in response to decrease. This is data from the National Law Enforcement Officer Memorial Fund, and they use FBI statistics for this one. So in 1970 down to 2014, I don't know what happened in, 2001. 9/11?
9/11.
But it's, a noticeable trend down. But news stories about violence against the police have gone up, have increased significantly. We have from 2005 here, and then 2014, a huge spike. There were a different study that I've used quite a bit in class, which is, I couldn't find a nice graph for, but looked at how often it was covered. And over the course of several years, while police deaths went down, coverage went up 600% the way that they measured it, right? So they weren't using news stories like this. They were using TV news stories. And it skyrocketed 600% news stories, but the actual rate went down. Yeah?
My question was this, like, sometimes a local story will be carried on other stations. Does this count each one of those?
Yes, it does. Mm-hmm. And it also counts if an officer was killed and it went to many different stations, or if there was violence against the police and it went to many different stations. Yes, it's not like the number of events, but how frequently it was told. So we see this a lot where we hear about it for several days. Like, we're reminded of it over and over and over again. So all of that stuff would be in here. All right, death penalty. I hear something.
Oh. That was right.
Okay. How many of you are right on this one? Okay, fewer people. Yeah, so we oftentimes think that death penalty is a deterrent effect, and it's not a deterrent. So it doesn't mean that everyone thinks we should have the death penalty because of a deterrent effect. Some people want it because of retribution, right? But it's not related. States that don't have the death penalty have lower homicide rates. Right? It's not causal, right? It's probably caused by something else. But if someone's justification for having the death penalty is because it's a deterrent, it's not true. It is not a deterrent. Yes?
We have a question about whether this reflects somehow the amount of homicide that would be there without the death penalty. That would be very difficult to get data on.
It would be.
Maybe the reason that they have the death penalty is because there was already a lot of homicide in there, but necessary to have.
Yeah,
it was more necessary because there were already more homicides.
And to look at that, you have to go back to historical data because states have had death penalties for a long time. And one of the conversations I've had with people this week is about social science data, right? So some of the numbers I hear are just snippets of information, and hopefully it's representative of a general trend. One of the things that sociologists struggle with is that we can't, my perspective anyways, is that we can't usually prove something. We can't prove that A causes B because there's always social factors that we can't identify or can't measure. So we talk a lot about trends. We can say we're 95% certain that A is related to B. We're 99.9% sure, right, that poverty causes a lot of social problems. But I err on the side of caution because social trends change, how we use terms change, how we see things changes. And so we really can rarely say A causes B. And with experiments, like you were talking about up there, it's the same kind of thing. So, you know, most psychology experiments, they put you in a room and they control for as many variables as possible, because if you want good information, you have to control for all these different other factors that could influence it. In a social situation, if we control for all those factors, you're going to know that you're in an experiment, and you're not going to give the right answer, right? And so that's why sociologists really don't use experiments all that often. We have used experiments for things like racial discrimination for interviews, where they will randomly select, they'll send in, for example, 2 resumes that are kind of underqualified for a job and 2 that are overqualified for a job, and they will be of different racial backgrounds. Like, so 2 of the underqualified, 1 will be white and 1 will be a racial minority, same with the overqualified ones. And then they see like what percentage of people get callbacks. They can do that sort of experiment. They also do ones on, there's several about race and felony convictions. So several studies have documented that whites with a felony on their record are more likely to get called back for an interview than black applicants without a felony, which is super depressing. I mean, it's awful. And so, you know, we can do those kind of experiments, and especially if you do that, several of them, right? We never, ever, ever want to make any kind of policy decision based on one study, right? You need several studies done by different people, assessing things slightly differently to see if there's actually a trend or not. All right, between 1980 and 2016, incarceration rates have increased by quite a bit. Here is the nice little chart here from the Bureau of Justice Statistics. They've gone up. They're going down slightly. This was talked about in a presentation earlier this week, too, incarceration rates. So, yeah, and then there's so many social issues that are difficult to address for someone who leaves prison and has a felony on their record. It's hard to get loans. It's hard to get jobs. It's hard to get all sorts of things. Those compounding, compounding impact. All right, so we have rates of violent crime victimization. They stayed about the same. I suspect that when we get official data from 2016, that will be going up quite significantly. I mean, I know it will. I know it will.
Did they collect it before 2004?
You know, that's a good question. I doubt it, because something being designated as a hate crime has not always happened. And when something is a hate crime, it can increase the amount of punishment that if it's designated as a hate crime. So I guess this might be a good time to tell you what I'm doing on Wednesday and Thursday for my sessions. So the week after Trump was elected, we had 4 incidents of racial graffiti on my campus. And we hadn't had any ever. And as a result, being a member of the sociology department and being very close friends with one of my colleagues, who is the only African-American who is tenured at our school, we are the social department. We get a lot of stuff sent our way like this. And he is at a breaking point in terms of dealing with these issues. So everything on campus that's race-related goes to him, and it's all stressful. And he's going through all of these things. In Minneapolis, we've had, you know, African-American men killed by police, and he gets pulled over a lot, and basically I couldn't take it. So I just proposed to administration. They were not asking for a proposal, but I submitted one anyways, saying we need to do something about this. We need to show students that as a campus we care what's going on, and we have diversity committees meeting and goal areas and all this kind of stuff. I was on goal area 5, student retention. But that is not what students care about, right? That we're meeting behind the scenes. So I propose that we go get into classrooms and just start talking about kind of diversity-related things in a positive way, in a way that we're not just sitting there like, oh, crap, like we're screwed. This is horrible. But in a more proactive way. So I did some bystander intervention dialogue and stuff like that. So on Wednesday, tomorrow, I'm going to be talking about bystander intervention in person. So if you're in a situation where you see things that aren't right, what are options that you could do to try to make the situation better? We usually think about either direct intervention, which is, you know, going to the person who's the bully or the harasser or whatever label and saying, stop what you're doing, right? So we either do that or we do nothing. And there's so many options in between that are possibly more effective than direct intervention, actually. So we're going to be talking about that on Wednesday. And then on Thursday, we're going to be talking about how to intervene when you see things happening on social media. Because they're completely different. When it's in person at that time, you have to make a decision kind of right away because it's unfolding right in front of you. And you might have a threat of physical danger, right? But on social media, you usually have time to think about it a little bit before you respond. And so we're going to be talking about that kind of stuff on Thursday. All right. The percentage of U.S. high school students reporting that drugs were made available to them has decreased. This is one that I totally thought would have increased. It has decreased from 1995. Someone asked about the years for some of these, 1993 and 2015. I forgot who that was. All right, now looking at bullying. We hear a lot about bullying, or if you are in school, if you've been in school for the last decade or so, you've seen lots of anti-bullying campaigns, and we've heard about it in the media. If we look at the U.S. compared to other nations, we are actually about average. I don't know what specific questions they used to assess this. I don't know if you can even see up there what countries they are. Barely, yeah.
Bahrain at the top.
Yep.
Qatar, Republic of...
Yeah, we have Bahrain, Qatar, Saudi Arabia.
The Republic of
Korea.
Yeah, Korea, Ireland, Sweden, Norway, Kazakhstan. I don't hear. All right, number 24. The percentage of high school students reporting that they have been in a physical fight in the previous 12 months has also decreased. So I was also surprised by that. How many of you got that one right? All right, a few people. Nice up there at the top. So we have anywhere and then on school property. In both areas, it has decreased. 25. Gangs has also decreased. I mean, not that gangs have decreased, but 12 to 18-year-olds are less aware of them during the school year. Here we have, again, they have broken up into urban, suburban, and rural. And then once again, they're all going down. So there's a lot of positive things that are happening in society, really. All right. Here the answer is Mexican. Did anybody get this one right? Okay. Three people got it right. So I love this one, this question, because, I mean, I threw it in there because it's sort of a trick question. So there was no kind of Mexican Hispanic category in 1820. Okay. And Hindu was actually labeled as a race, which is strange. So, you know, I was talking earlier about the census and how they have these things, and if anyone's interested, I can give you that website because it's really fascinating. And there's also a website that I use in my intro class where we talk about how different countries define race differently. So Brazil, I think their categories are white, black, brown, yellow. Okay. And that's how they see racial groups. That's how they have constructed them in their society. Here is the actual image. So the categories that they had in 1920, when people filled out the census, white, black, mulatto, other, Indian, as in Native American, American Indian, Chinese, Japanese, Filipino, Korean, and Hindu.
It's really oddly specific.
Yeah, it's very specific. Yeah, and it's because at that time, it was important for people in the 20s, apparently, to differentiate between these groups.
They were the immigrant populations.
Yeah. Yes.
And they used black, not African American.
Right. African American was not used until about 1980.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. And now I think the categories are black, African American, and Negro. That is still kind of listed on the same line because there are some black folks in the South who are older who identify with that label, basically. I imagine that in 20 years, that will no longer be officially on the census. All right, what percentage of U.S. adults say people being harassed or bullied online is a major social problem? 62%. So, yep, this is the top graph here. The top graph. Ooh, look at that. 62%, 33% a minor, and 5% don't think it's a problem at all. And what I think is interesting is actually the next question, which asks them what they think is the most effective way to deal with it. Better policies, stronger laws, peer pressure, and increased focus and attention from law enforcement. What I noticed right away about this is that only 15% of the people basically think that maybe we should do something about it as people. And all the rest are like, other people should try to control it, right? And I find that fascinating. Myself. You know, we talk, like Chris was talking about, we talk about individual level, the micro level, we talk about the meso or the organizational level, and then we talk about macro or the cultural level, right? So I just find that fascinating that we think, other people should come up with those laws because I don't want to get involved in that. It's not exactly what it's saying, but that's how I kind of interpret it. All right, so we have three more questions left. Household income has decreased for all racial and ethnic groups. So the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. There's no doubt about it. None whatsoever. We don't need to go over all these details, but basically what we can see here is it has decreased for all. It has decreased the most for Asian Americans. And so I just included, you can take a look at it yourself, but the amount it went down and then the income levels. So this question is about income. I think it's the next one that's about net worth. Okay. So what are some guesses that you had for the difference between white Americans' net worth and those of Latinos and African Americans? What are some guesses that you had?
15
times.
15
times?
3 times.
10.
100.
100? 3?
4.
10 times.
10.
So net worth is something that it accumulates over decades in families' histories. And so net worth includes not just your income, of course, but all property that you might own, cabins that you own, boats that you own, and also your liabilities. And there are many, many, many people whose net worth is negative. I wish I had that information here. We talk about it in my intro class. But there's a significant number of portion of people who have a negative net worth, even when you don't include mortgages. All right, so this we have just a quick graph looking at the racial and ethnic wealth gaps. We have white net worth here, let's see, right here, and black here and Hispanic here. So about 10 times. I just kind of combined them. It's actually over 10, but I was kind of combining them into one question. So nope, Asian is not on here. On this particular one. It's not as much. And it. What was that?
It's off the charts.
It's off the charts. That's good. I like that. All right, and the last one is 7 years. So here's the actual information. They have divided it into three different categories, gay men, lesbians, bisexuals, and
I figured it was 4 years.
This color here, and they're all green, so this color green is when the person self-identified as like they thought they might be. The middle column is when they knew for sure. And the column on the right is when they told someone.
Okay. Can you read the numbers?
Yes, here?
Yeah, I mean, just, the, yeah, are those the, like, 10?
Yeah, so these are 10, at age 10, age 15, and age 18. 13, 18, and 21, 13, 17, and 20. And remember, these are averages, so young people today, this is if you're just going to look at, for example, people 25 and under, it's going to be very different. But this includes people like my coworker who probably didn't, I don't know when he knew himself, but he was married and he had two kids, and he came out to his wife and family at the age of about 60, right? So that includes everybody. And that's the last question. All right, so do you have any kind of questions or comments? Or I just like to do these things because I myself am shocked often at what, you know, I think I know, only to find out that I have a lot to learn. And anyway, so I love that how all these things tie in. I'm just going to talk about one more thing before you go, and that's qualitative and quantitative data. So today, Gary was, anyone here go to Gary's session? Yeah, several people, and he was talking about the importance of stories. And so stories are used in sociology a lot, but that's in the form of qualitative information, whereas all this is the quantitative stuff. And so when you look at things like social policies, what we usually need are a combination of both. If you want to pass domestic violence or intimate partner violence, sexual violence legislation, you're going to need to have the qualitative part. You're going to need to have people testify and tell their stories and how it has impacted them and what it has meant for them. But you also need to have the numbers, the statistics about what kind of prevention programs work. How big of a problem is this? Because if we only rely on the qualitative, the stories for public policy, we're going to be making really bad public policy because those stories could be non-representative of the general social trend. Yeah.
Do you have a happiness scale based on the results of the number you got correct or not?
I don't.
So you're more optimistic about the nation as a whole or more pessimistic that we're going into the toilet?
That's a good question.
I'm not very happy.
I am an educator, and I think that we have to be optimistic, honestly, because a lot of my students at a community college come very unprepared for academic success, and I see growth in students, and I see, you know, I specifically assign a paper at the end of the semester that makes me want to keep teaching because it can be a lot of work to be reading and leading class discussions on controversial topics many, many weeks in a row. It's very draining.
I guess my impression from the results is the world is not as bad as I thought it was.
Please notice that I handpicked these.
Yeah.
Questions, right? And I did it, you know, sort of that way because so many people think that we are, that everything's getting worse.
Yeah.
And it's not. I mean, there are many things that are improving. We just don't hear about them. So I heard the bell ring. So that's all we have for today. Hopefully I'll see some of you on Wednesday and Friday when we talk about kind of different options that we have for intervening, and it'll be more interactive than today. All right, thank you.